Liber Segundus. A voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world. A voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world. Those are the words with which Jung best described the journey recorded in Liber Novus. The metaphor of an exploration always has struck me as appropriate and useful when looking at what Jung did. And, of course, Jung used it himself. One might say, extending the metaphor, that from this exploration, his exploration of the mythopoetic imagination, he later was able to sketch a map of where he had been. And that map really is his psychology. He was able to define, with terminology, the terrain where he had been. The stages of the journey into this reality. And for C.G. Jung, it was a reality. It was the hidden half of human reality. It was part of our nature, of our human nature. Jung gave this general map of the journey in his psychological language. He offered a vocabulary that helps define these landmark experiences of the journey. But one, again, must remember that it's a map based largely upon his experience. Although he spent years trying to validate his conclusions from the reports of his patients, and also, importantly, from historical material, reports of history. However, until one walks into this other pole of reality, the map is just a jumble of symbols on a page. The words are empty until they're filled with experience. Let me briefly review that map. The map he drew. And this really is the outline of any basic introduction to Jungian psychology. One starts with the fact of the conscious personhood, the conscious self, the conscious me, I. And then, one day, a wizard comes and makes a mark on the door. And the next thing you know, you have 10 dwarves sitting in the dining room, and they're telling you that you have to go on an adventure to find a hidden treasure. Or something like that. It's different for each and every one of us. Some of us just find ourselves one day on the floor vomiting out life. All of it. And knowing that we can't go on any longer like we have. That we need a different food. A different sustenance to carry us forward with life. This doesn't happen to everybody. As a Dutch friend of mine said, there's a saying in Dutch that normal is crazy enough. And for many people, that's where it stops. But some people find themselves in that place where they need more. They don't know what it is, but they know it's got to be different. There has to be more. And so the search begins. At the beginning of the wandering, there comes a consciousness of the masks we have been wearing in our relationship with the world, both inner and outer. The methods we have decorated or costumed ourselves or veiled ourselves, the makeup hiding our true face, our persona, our dramatic mask in the world. Stripping the mask away, we see in the mirror a reflection, the other side of ourselves, the shadow behind our conscious personality. The conscious personality we previously knew as me, as self. That begins to manifest the darker and hidden facts about who we are. The harsh brother or sister within, the negative image we have failed to confront before, and now often meet as our own personal devil. That devil has several ways of manifesting when we do finally look, and none of them are very pleasant. They are not comforting images. And in fact, few people make it past this point in their own psychological self-reflection. Seeing one's personhood in all of its light and dark can be just too damned painful. It's a threshold that's difficult to endure. And when we look in this mirror, most of us, most often, quickly grab our makeup case and put the mask right back on. But some people know they need to make it through that. They need to journey on. So if we pass this threshold experience, we begin to meet images of inner reality, deeper reality within us. Things light and dark. Images of the soulful self hidden in the shadows. And there are often our contrasexual images, the anima or the animus, that present themselves at this point. The other half of ourselves. Beyond this encounter, there await myriad images of deep psychic reality. It seems that we must enter this unknown realm with the company of our soulful fact, of a soulful fact. That soulful fact becomes a critical support and a guide within the alien realm of the objective psyche. Now, many Jungian analysts, so-called Jungians, individuals who have memorized well Jung's map, and who even believe that they know a bit about it from their personal experience and experience with their patients, are completely baffled by Jung's wanderings in Liber Novus. It seems Jung went a few places that, they had not imagined. And here one simply has to remember that the map is not the experience. The experience comes first. The exploration, the journey, the voyage of discovery comes first. Only after the journey can one evaluate the utility, the validity of any map the explorer might leave. So, Liber Novus is the record of Jung's journey. His way. And his way is not your way, it's not my way. Few people will, or perhaps even could, follow in the steps of Jung. But we can hear his account. So for now, just forget the maps, okay? Listen to the explorer tell you what he saw. Listen to his first-hand account of what he met. Later on, after that, then you can better understand the map. The events Jung relates had certain relationship to his personal life. The facts of his life, his moment in human history, and questions that were uniquely his questions. Jung starts the journey from the place where he stood in life. It is for this reason that I felt it really important, critically important, that I spend so much time in the last few sessions talking about the man and his history, his clinical history. I believe those facts help orient an understanding of what's now happening in Liber Novus. In in-dream relationship with his soul, Jung was meeting the substrata of himself and his own fate, the fate he lived, the fate that awaited him. He was facing the shadow world behind his relationships. The world of relationship with thinking, with desiring, with love. He had to meet personal facts, his personal facts. He could not move to things deeper, things that are perhaps less personal and more objective, without passing through that initial encounter. In Liber Primus, which we've talked about up to this point, and now in the first few sections that we're going to talk about tonight of Liber Segundus, the second book, the second section of the Red Book of Liber Novus, Jung is facing images of these personal issues. But by the middle of Liber Segundus, he has clearly passed beyond definable personal factors into the depths of the objective psyche. The figures and events he faces there are no longer exclusively personal devils. He's facing the fact of God. Now, that's a big word. God. Jung is struggling with what he perceives as God. With the Word made flesh. And with the experience from which all religious symbols ultimately derive, so he came to understand. That's a hard one. But you will meet that in this book. So let me review what happened in Liber Primus up to this point. Jung is immersed in open visual hallucinations in 1913, in October. He senses he might be on the verge of psychosis, of utter dissolution. He determines that he must go into the psyche and meet whatever it is that's awaiting him. And so, on November the 12th of 1913, he petitions his soul. He spends almost a month sitting night by night, seeking any and all forms of communication back from his inner realm, from his psyche, from this place that had submerged him in these visions of utter destruction. He develops a technique to invoke fantasies, imagination, vision, and he is successful, digging. He finds the threshold of vision in this first major evoked vision of the cave in mid to early December of 1913. Then at Christmas 1913, the doors of perception blow wide open. He experiences the mysterium that we talked about last time, the meeting with Elijah and Salome. And Jung states that nothing else in his entire experience recorded in Liber Novus had the character, the quality, and the intensity of this vision. He called it the mystery play. And in this play, Jung was on center stage. Having passed that threshold, he entered the world of vision, the mytho-poetic imagination was a reality he explored. Like a wanderer in a new world. It's a door few of us will ever approach, let alone pass through in that manner. But he did. This is where Liber Segundus, the material we're going to speak about tonight, begins. It begins the night after the Mysterium, the night after Christmas, December 26th, of 1913. The night after Jung found himself on that cross as a sacrifice. Oh, and where did Christ go after that redemptive sacrifice on the cross? Uh-oh. Okay. Meet this moment. Everything I have spoken about here for the last 3 months has been oriented to this moment. Everything that Jung was doing in his life, walking toward, was oriented to this moment. It was his path to this moment. Now he really entered into this inner world. He meets the visions emerging from the psyche night after night in this early winter of 1914. This event burned its mark on his life. Now it's your turn to stand there with him. I talked about clinical history. Okay. Meet this guy. Can you imagine what it'd be like having a client like Jung give you a call, make an appointment for Thursday, and come down and say, I have to talk to you 4 days a week. I'm really having trouble. And then sit there 4 days a week for the next 3 months telling you what this guy had been going through night by night. Well, folks, here you are. This is a human being. Important one, it seems. What happened to him? Had a lot of repercussions in our world. He's your patient. Listen. What the hell is going on with this dude? Have you ever listened to a dream that somebody's telling you so intensely that you could see the dream, that you entered into it? Do that with this. Try it. Let it be that immediate. It's not easy. But if you approach it as you would approach a friend or a client, sitting there talking to you, telling you something that they really wanted to communicate and find meaning in, and share, you might actually get there. You are trying to understand this patient, this teacher, this physician. And you're also trying to understand your own life, your own human life. A little bit about the structure of Liber Secundus. I should here add, a fellow who's a very prominent, famous Jungian analyst with 30 years of experience. I've been intensely interested in anticipating the coming of the Red Book. And when it arrived, he dived in head first. And he told me that he thought he could really follow it all the way through Liber Primus. But when he got to Liber Secundus, he said, to quote him exactly, shit, I was sunk. I couldn't figure out what was going on. But that can happen. So I'm going to try to give you a few guides here. And I'm going to be quoting a lot from Liber Secundus tonight, but I have to tell you that I'm cutting this material down considerably. I've had to edit considerably and pull things out that I think are signal. So what I'm giving you are really snippets as I read tonight. So the structure of Liber Secundus. Originally in his handwritten draft that Jung created about a year after the visions themselves had occurred, he called this book The Adventures of the Wandering. And he divided it into 10 wandering events. 10 adventures. When he did the final transcription into Liber Novus, into the calligraphic volume, he admitted that terminology and he admitted those names. But they do give a useful outline pattern of how he first framed what happened. And remember that Jung is relating real imaginative events. a nightly fantasy or vision, as recorded in his Black Book Journal. And then he is giving or attaching a commentary which was written 9 to 12 months after. And believe me, throughout all that year, he had been thinking a great deal, feeling, trying to understand this rupture of consciousness that he had undergone. So the first 9 of these imaginative wanderings recorded in Liber Novus occur either on a single evening or on a series of evenings. And if you look in Dr. Shamdasani's footnotes, he'll tell you the dates and when these things happened. And again, remember, this is a clinical record. The man kept a diary of those nights. It's written down as it happened, okay? This isn't some sort of literary creation. It's a clinical record. At least one can see it in that way from one perspective, the perspective I'm suggesting to you. These events, these wanderings, begin on December 26th and they continue through January 14th. One half a month. I mean, this was a volcanic eruption. The 10th adventure, called The Magician, that you find at the last part of Liber Novus, extends over several months from about the 27th of January through April. And then Liber Secundus ends. The events recorded and commented in Liber Secundus really came to a conclusion in April of 1914. So we're really talking about a relatively condensed period of time. And this was coming out of you night by night. And then again, remember, during the day, this guy was functioning. He was lecturing. He was seeing patients. He was taking care of a very complex domestic situation. And I won't go into that. He wasn't incapacitated. But he sure as hell was engaged. Let's just put it this way. The guy had a night job. Okay? But he knew he had to keep his day job. And what was the day job? It was trying to understand what the hell was the night job. It took a lot of time to write this stuff down. It would happen, and he would write it. I don't know how the man slept, and I suspect, based on some of his journal entries, that during this period, he wasn't sleeping a whole lot. He was up late trying to record what had happened and find some perspective. And of course, some of this perspective comes in that commentary or layer that he writes the next fall and winter. Okay. And then ways of reading Liber Novus. I've talked to you about the visionary layer and then the commentary layer. Dr. Shamdasani, the editor of the Red Book, suggests that really one ought to read this. If you want to sort of understand, follow it, that you ought to start by reading just the visions, one after the other, without any of the commentary that he added. So just read straight through with the vision, the vision, the vision. And this really would be more like your clinical encounter with Dr. Jung, your patient, sitting there telling you what was happening night by night. And then after you read through that layer, go back and read the commentary that he wrote the next year. That really gives it to you as it happened to him and gives a different perspective. Now, after going through the book quite a few times, I did do this, and it is very helpful. But I don't know if I'd recommend it for your first reading. Sometimes you just have to dive in, meet the stuff, be astounded, be confused, then go back for that next reading. Or not. Put it on the coffee table. It's pretty. You don't have to read it. Don't have to. Well, you really don't. No, no. But you should. Okay. So Liber Secundus opens on the same note, but in a different key from Liber Primus. Now, you remember Liber Primus, the first folio page, is this series of quotations from the prophet Isaiah and the signal declaration of the coming of a new age, and the Word was made flesh, from the Gospel of John. A very prophetic tone. And that paper I shared with you that was published in Psychological Perspectives last quarter on Jung and Ion talks about that folio page. And I'll approach some of those issues in our very last seminar. But take note that he starts Liber Secundus with similar biblical quotations also on a prophetic tone, but somewhat different. He starts with two readings from the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 23, verse 16. Hearken not unto the words of the prophets that prophesy unto you. They make you vain. They speak a vision of their own heart, and not out of the mouth of the Lord. And Jeremiah chapter 23, verses 25 through 28. I have heard what the prophets said, that prophecy lies in my name, saying, I have dreamed, I have dreamed. How long shall this be in the heart of the prophets that prophesy lies? Yea, they are prophets of the deceit of their own heart, which think to cause my people to forget my name by their dreams, which they tell every man to his neighbor, as their fathers have forgotten my name for Baal. The prophet that hath a dream, let him tell a dream. And he that hath my word, let him speak my word faithfully. What is the chaff to the wheat, saith the Lord? Jung actually cited this same verse that he used here in Psychological Types, which he wrote just a few years after this event. And after discussing the formation of Christian orthodoxy and how the original experience of the Christian tradition was honored and then was declared immutable and incorporated, structured into a church form, that original experience, original revelation, was considered heresy. Jung says, thereafter, all individual fantasies became odious and worthless and were persecuted as heretical, as the fate of the Gnostic movement and all later heresies testifies. The prophet Jeremiah is speaking just in this vein when he warns, hearken not unto the words of the prophets that prophesy unto you. They make you vain. They speak a vision of their own heart, and not out of the mouth of the Lord. That's how it starts. And then comes the first vision of Liber Segundus, the meeting with the Red One. He starts in preface. The door of the Mysterium has closed behind me. I feel that my will is paralyzed and the spirit of the depths possesses me. I know nothing about a way. I can therefore neither want this nor that, since nothing indicates to me whether I want this or that. Without knowledge, what I'm waiting for. But already in the following night, I felt that I had reached a solid point. And here he begins the vision. I find that I am standing on the highest tower of a castle. The air tells me so. I am far back in time. My gaze wanders widely over solitary countryside, a combination of fields and forests. I'm wearing a green garment. A horn hangs from my shoulder. I am the tower guard. I look out into the distance. I see a red point out there. It comes nearer on a winding road, disappearing for a while in the forests and reappearing again. It is a horseman in a red coat. The red horseman. He is coming to my castle. He is already riding through the gate. I hear footsteps on the stairway. The steps creak. He knocks. A strange fear comes over me. There stands the Red One, his long shape wholly shrouded in red. Even his hair is red, I think. In the end, he will turn out to be the devil. A strange fear comes over you. Again, this is a lived experience, as if it were really happening. Jung related to Agnello Jaffe in 1957 when he was doing the dialogues that were refined into Memory Stream's Reflections, edited into Memory Stream's Reflections, that some of these events recorded here were driven by fear. And he points this out as one, particularly of fear. Because the conversation, actually, as you read it, seems absurd, almost comical, it's a little bit hard to get that. But I suppose even a comical conversation with the devil might be frightening. So Jung asks, "Who are you?" The red one confronts him. "Who am I?" "You think I'm the devil. Do not pass judgment. Perhaps you can also talk to me without knowing who I am. What sort of superstitious fellow are you that immediately think I'm the devil?" The conversation circles around back and forth. Then Jung asks, and remember here, Jung has just been through the Mysterium the night before, right? He's been through this amazing religious symbolism. And he says to the red one, "Have you never broken your heart over the holiest mysteries of our Christian religion?" And the red one says, "You're an unbelievably ponderous and serious person. Are you always so urgent? You're superstitious and all too German. You take literally what the scriptures say. Otherwise, you could not judge me so hard." Conversation goes on a little bit more. Then the red one more fully reveals himself. He seems to get redder. His garments shine like glowing iron. The red one, "I hide nothing from you, true-hearted soul. I simply amuse myself with your weighty seriousness and your comic veracity. This is so rare in our time, especially in men who have understanding at their disposal." And then Jung replies, "I believe you cannot fully understand me. You apparently compare me with those who you know. But I must say to you, for the sake of truth, that I neither really belong to this time or this place. A spell has banished me to this place for years. I am really not what you see before you." The red one, "You say astounding things. Who are you then?" Jung, "That is irrelevant. I stand before you as that which I presently am. Why I am here and like this, I do not know. I know just as little who you are as you know who I am." Are you getting the intensity of the visionary quality of this? The reality of it? And this is the astonishing thing that I find almost impossible to communicate. You really have to meet this. That the guy really is doing this. That he's really there. He is meeting this material with a veracity, with an acceptance of its reality that is, well, should I say incomprehensible? Nearly incomprehensible? Difficult to comprehend? I mean, look, many people do active imaginations. I've done that. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's going on with this dude? And he knew that this didn't happen to many people. Except perhaps some of his very, very, very psychotic patients. Who had completely dissolved at the sense of egohood. "Why I am here and like this, I do not know." And the conversation goes on. I can't read it all. The red one confronts Jung with this, with his ponderous solemnity. "You argue your case well, but your solemnity, You could make matters much easier for yourself. If you're no saint, I really don't see why you have to be so solemn. You wholly spoil the fun. What the devil is troubling you? Only Christianity, with its mournful escape from the world, can make people so ponderous and sullen. And Jung replies, I think there are still other things that bespeak seriousness. The red one replies, oh, I know. You mean life. I know this phrase. I too live. And don't let my hair turn white over it. Life doesn't require any seriousness. On the contrary, it's better to dance through life. And at this, Jung ponders dance. Yes, dance, like the mating dance, dance. But perhaps one can also dance before his God. This seems to touch something in the devil. And he lightens up, he becomes more human in appearance, and he says, doffing his red mask, don't you recognize me, brother? I am joy. Jung, could you be joy? I see you as through a cloud. Your image fades. Let me take your hand, beloved. Who are you? Who are you? Joy. Was he joy? The vision fades. Last week we talked about Jung and some of the personal conflicts, personal issues in his life, things that he was dealing with at this point, age 38, right? We talked about his thought, idea, and his desiring, the issues of love, joy, pleasure. Is his personal devil tinkering with this issue in his personality, pushing something to the fore? This is Jung's commentary. Surely this red one was the devil, but my devil. That is, he was my joy. The joy of the serious person who keeps watch alone on the high tower, his red-colored, red-scented, warm, bright, red joy, that strange joy of the world that comes unsuspected like a warm southerly wind with swelling fragrant blossoms and the ease of living. It picks up men like a wave and drives them forth. Whoever tastes this joy forgets himself. And there is nothing sweeter than forgetting oneself. I earnestly confronted my devil and behaved with him as with a real person. This I learned in the Mysterium, to take seriously every unknown wanderer who personally inhabits the inner world, since they are real because they are effectual. They are real because they are effectual. What does that mean? They are real because they are effectual. Yeah, they're just as real. Like, if a guy almost runs you off the road, right? He's real, and he pisses you off. He was effectual. He got something out of you. And yet, you can wake up in the morning feeling like you'd just been run off the road. Something inside of you has got you. And that's effectual, too. Look, I'll give you the first time I ever sort of caught on to this. When I was in college, I decided that I was going to be a backpacker. And I'm always excessive. And so I went out and bought a backpack and decided I was going to go way the hell up in the middle of the High Uinta Mountains on my first backpacking trip. Up over Rocky Sea Pass to a little place called Lightning Lake, way the hell up there. And this is a long time ago. Not many people went there back then. So I got my stuff together, started early, hiked way the hell up there. over Rocky Sea Pass to this little place called Lightning Lake. And let me add, I know why it's called Lightning Lake. Okay? That's another part of the story. But so I'm sitting there. I have a little tarp. I don't have a tent. You know, that's too much for me. I just make a little lean-to, you know, old pioneer style. Get ready, start getting my fire ready, and then it's getting dark, it's beautiful, and then I notice there's a problem. There's a full moon rising. Full moon. I'm alone, and really alone, in the middle of the mountains. Full moon. And I realize that these are circumstances under which werewolves appear. But I don't believe in werewolves. Werewolves aren't real. I don't believe in werewolves. They aren't real. They're no werewolves. Okay, and so I'm watching the full moon rise. I'm sitting there with my heart in my throat going 150 beats a second on the edge of a panic attack. And I'm in the situation where it's like, so what the hell does it matter that I don't believe in werewolves? Because it seems like something inside of me believes in werewolves, or why would I be about ready to scream? Finally, I just got in my sleeping bag. I zipped it up over my head. I mean, really, it was like the kid, you know, pulls the cover. I zipped it over my head and said, okay, if I die, I die. This is it. And then at 2 in the morning, I hear something moving. I awaken in absolute panic. My heart is real. I mean, I'm really in tachycardia. I unzip the bag as quick as I can, try to grab a flashlight. I know what I'm going to be facing. And there it was. The world's most ferocious porcupine. Was looking me in the face. Okay. Real, because there are effectual. I mean, you know, that's sort of, well, it's a fact. There are things we don't believe in, that we don't consider real, but they're pretty damn effectual. In our affect, in our behavior, in our inability to sleep, in our panic attack. There are psychic autonomous complexes that are effectual. They may not even have constellated into consciousness in full form, but they're there in the shadows, waiting for us. What was that? They're there. Okay. Jung elaborated this point in 1928 while presenting a talk on active imagination. And he said, the scientific credo of our time has developed a superstitious phobia about fantasy. A superstitious phobia about fantasy. But the real is what works. The fantasies of the unconscious work. There can be no doubt about that. And then he summarizes this adventure of the wandering. Through my coming to terms with the devil, he accepted some of my seriousness, and I accepted some of his joy. This gave me courage. It is always a risky thing to accept joy, but it leads us to life and its disappointment, from which the wholeness of our life becomes. Then, on December 28th, comes the next adventure. 2 nights later, he says, in the second night thereafter, I am walking alone in a dark forest, and I notice that I have lost my way. I am on a dark tract and stumble through the darkness. I finally come to a quiet, dark swamp of water, and a small old castle stands at its center. I think it would be good to ask here for the night's lodging. So, I'll just tell the story best I can. So he goes up to the door and knocks. Servant comes down, conducts him into the castle, takes him up the stairs, into the cluttered study of an old scholar. The old fellow is sitting there at his desk working away, piles of books and manuscripts around him. He hardly even notices that Jung is standing there. That's, oh, well, here you are. Why are you disturbing me? Well, I need a place to stay. Okay. And then he goes back to writing in his desk. Then he looks up again and says, oh, why are you still here? He says, well, I need a place to stay. Oh, okay, and calls his servant. The servant conducts Jung up to a spare bedroom. Jung goes into the bedroom, lays down, is sitting there, and starts thinking. Okay, what happens next in this fantasy? Oh my, let's see. Bet the old man has a daughter. Oh yes, yes, his daughter's going to show up. She's going to walk in the room here. And, oh my God, this is romantic trash. It's a farmer's daughter joke. Is that the seriousness of my imagination? A dime store novel? That's the imaginative realm? And my God, it's hell to be resurrected in a lending library. And then he hears something. He hears her enter his room. Have you come at last? She asks quietly. Jung, impossible. This is a cruel mistake. The novel wants to become real. Does it want to grow into some silly ghost story? To what nonsense am I damned? Is it my soul that harbors such novelistic brilliance? Must this happen to me? I am truly in hell, the worst awakening after death, to be resurrected in a lending library. Then she says, oh, so you think me common? Do you let yourself be deluded by the wretched delusion that I belong in a novel? You as well, whom I hoped had thrown off appearances and striven after the essence of things? Jung looks at her. Forgive me, but are you real? She, you wretch, how can you doubt that I'm real? Jung, I scratch my head. Is this not some hellish banality? Word for word pulp fiction? Oh, you gods, where have you led me? But still, she lies there, crying. What if she were real? Then Jung accepts her reality. The reality of a banal fantasy. Jung, my dear child, I believe you. Despite everything, that you are real. What can I do for you? She, finally a word from a human mouth. She gets up. Her face is beaming. She is beautiful. A deep purity rests in her. She has a beautiful and unworldly soul, one that wants to come in to the life of reality. She, what can you do for me? You've already done much for me. You spoke the redeeming word when you no longer placed the banal between you and me. Know then, I was bewitched by the banal. Do not let the fabulous come between us. Only what is human and what you call banal and hackneyed contains the wisdom you seek. The fabulous does not speak against me, but for me, and proves how universally human I am, and how much I, too, not only need redemption, but also deserve it. Jung, strange maiden, you are bewildering. You give me matters to ponder. You are uncommon. She, you are mistaken. I am very common. Jung, I can't believe that. How beautiful and worthy of adoration is the expression of your soul in your eyes. Happy and enviable is the man who will free you. She. Do you love me? Jung. By God, I love you. But, unfortunately, I am married. She. So you see, even banal reality is a redeemer. I thank you, dear friend, and I bring you greetings from Salome. End of the vision. Banal reality is a redeemer. What does that mean? What does she mean? Banal reality is a redeemer.
That his desires and his love life are basically gateways to the spiritual existence for him, or deeper existence.
Look, how much of any love affair is in reality and how much is in fantasy? Especially at the beginnings. Maybe even before the beginnings. Actually, that's probably the best part of it. How much is fantasy? How much is reality? Huh?
Most is fantasy.
Most is fantasy. Shit. Ain't it the truth? But in that fantasy, well, you know, look, we always try to live the fantasy out, don't we? And it is, it can be wonderful for a while until it becomes dreadful. Until we're slapped upside the face by the confrontation of reality, right? I hate to be such a realist. I hate to be such a downer, okay? But I have been observing some of these things. It isn't always like this. Not always. I'm told not always, but often. Enough. Yes. You know, let me take first the first point that Stu just brought up here. That in the banal reality, even in the love story, there are elements that are talking about some of the deepest needs and wants and completions, perhaps, that a human soul might strive after. And we call it a dime store novel. But you know those dime store novels... Excuse me. Your dime store novel nowadays costs $5.99 at Kmart. People read those. Lots of them. They touch something in us that we want. In that banal reality, there are stories that are very much part of our psychic substrata. And then, everyday reality. You know, we're living stories every minute. Simple, simple stories. And not paying attention to what pulls us into them. A simple, common, banal fantasy, easily discarded as a story from a romance novel, fabulous and banal, can be redemptive. Jung goes on with this commentary later. If no outer adventure happens to you, then no inner adventure happens to you either. I think that's what Victor just sort of said. Outer adventure, inner adventure. No outer adventure happens, no inner adventure happens. Life wants to jump over such barriers, and you will fall out with yourself. Therefore, try to find your real limits. One never knows them in advance, but one sees and understands them only when one reaches them. And this happens to you only if you have balance. You achieve balance, however, only if you nurture your opposite. But that is hateful to you in your innermost core because it is not heroic. Not heroic. But it is hateful to you in your innermost core because it is not heroic. Nurture your opposite. Nurture your opposite. And that's not heroic? Huh?
What's the opposite of a hero?
Well, I guess the opposite of a hero is a hero's enemy, one you're going to defeat on the battlefield. Wouldn't be very heroic to go over and say, hey, buddy, let's just, like, you know, have a beer.
It might be a coward.
Huh?
It might be a coward opposite of a hero.
Yes, it might be a coward.
Shamil.
Shamil. But how do you nurture your opposite?
It's the coward that's within the hero.
Come to terms with it. How do you come to terms with your opposite? What was Jung's opposite? Let's ask that question. Any ideas? At this point, not, at age 38, his opposite? Jung, Siegfried, hero, savior of the world, through psychoanalysis.
Salome.
Yeah. Salome? Well, yeah. Jung, righteous, upright, Swiss Reformed Church.
The devil.
Ethical. The devil. Joy. Oh my God, Sabina. Desiring? Joy? Die Lust? I'm not giving you answers. I'm just saying he is actually working with us here. This is, and it's not he. And you, I say he's working with it. Well, what's working with it? His inner figures, right, are working with this. I remember I said that early in this Liber Segundus that there are really personal devils that seem to be coming out. I think there are here.
So this is very much like Steppenwolf, where for the serious person, learning how to play is the opposite.
Yeah. Look, I confess as a thinking type, that I've found it necessary to embrace my feelings. They are, however, difficult things, but it is really transformative to embrace them. However, I find it extraordinarily difficult to figure out how a feeling person could ever embrace thinking. And it's just my perspective. To me, embracing thinking is like embracing a porcupine. And I was like running a gauntlet of swords. Where embracing one's feelings, if that's one's opposite, it's sort of like diving into a raging surf of the sea. They're both very frightening in different ways. We all have our own difficult path. So Jung goes on in his commentary later, and he starts speaking about how his life has been up to this point. And he notes, this is one thing, speaking about how he has been. My spirit reflected in these past years of his life. My spirit reflected on everything rare and uncommon. It pried its way into unfound possibilities, toward paths that lead into the hidden, towards lights that shine in the night. And as my spirit did this, everything ordinary in me suffered harm without noticing it. And it began to hanker after life. Everything ordinary in me suffered harm without my noticing it. And it began to hanker after life, since I did not live it, this unlived part of himself. And maybe some of that we were talking about this last week in his relationships. Hence this adventure. I was smitten by the romantic. The romantic is a step backwards to reach the way. One must sometimes also take a few steps backward. Do you see any relationship between this episode of the old scholar? In the library, Jung goes up to the library, the old scholar doesn't pay him any attention, so he's taken to the room, and all of a sudden the girl shows up. Is there any relationship between this and Salome and Elijah? Do you see sort of those parallels there? Jung saw that. He says, in the adventure, I experienced what I had witnessed in the Mysterium. What I saw there as Salome and Elijah, became in life the old scholar and his pale, locked-up daughter. What I live is a distorted likeness of the Mysterium. What I live is a distorted likeness of the Mysterium. Following the romantic way, I reached the awkwardness and ordinariness of life, where I run out of thoughts and almost forgot myself. I accepted the absurdity of this adventure. No sooner had this happened than I saw how the maiden transformed herself and signified an autonomous meaning. One inquires into the desire of the ridiculous, and that is enough for it to change. A ridiculous fantasy appears in one's mind. Oh, ridiculous, off with that, and we forget it. But it was there. The ridiculous, even the ridiculous, the most ordinary, might have redeeming meaning. If one allows it to be real. It's there. And then at this point, Jung goes on into this long contemplation on masculine and feminine. Suddenly he starts this. And once again, I should add that these are threshold issues, again, that he's been facing. Things that he faces as he looks in the mirror, as he starts stripping away layers and encountering these issues in himself. And here he goes on. What about masculinity? Do you know how much femininity man lacks for completeness? Do you know how much masculinity woman lacks for completeness? You seek the feminine in women and the masculine in men. And thus there are always only men and women. But where are people? You, man, should not seek the feminine in women, but seek and recognize it in yourself, as you possess it from the beginning. You, woman, should not seek the masculine in men, but assume the masculine in yourself, since you possess it from the beginning. And then he adds this phrase, speaking to women. But it amuses you and is easy to play at femininity. Consequently, men despise you because he despises his femininity. Well, that was a pretty hard statement. What do you think of that?
Right on.
Huh?
Right on.
I thought people were going to be offended. I mean, that was a guy speaking. I want to hear a woman's voice on this one.
That huh? Sounds a little too much like bullying.
Huh?
I thought that was right on. It seemed so overly simplified to state it that way, but it covered a lot of things.
Yeah. Okay, let me give you a little bit more. Humankind is masculine and feminine, not just man or woman. Masculine and feminine, not just man or woman. You can hardly say to your soul what sex it is. If you remain with yourself as a man who is himself and not the devil, then you will remember your humanity. You will not behave towards women per se as a man, but as a human being. That is to say, as if you were of the same sex as her. You will recall your femininity. It is good for you once to put on women's clothes. People will laugh at you. But through becoming a woman, you attain freedom from women and their tyranny. Now, I want a note here. This is true in a lot of the Red Book. Jung is talking as a man to another guy. There's a lot of this in here where you really feel that the voice he is addressing is a masculine voice and it's sort of speaking in a masculine tenor. And I often ask women, are you noticing that? I notice it. And I try to hear it through my feminine ear as I listen to some of this. And my feminine ear, you know, it's a little bit off. I don't have any earrings on it. But I listen to some of this, and I wonder how it reflects to the feminine experience. The acceptance of femininity leads to completion. The same is valid for the woman who accepts her masculinity. A whole lot of Jungian's psychology, of what Jung talks about later in this issue of individuation, of coming to terms with anima, animus, it's circling right back to these visions, which, look, this had a personal background in the life of this human being coming to terms with what it was to be a human man in his time, facing what he faced. All right? But a lot of what we see as Jungian psychology now grows from this, okay? Real empirical human experience. One person's perhaps. But maybe there's some heads agreeing that this is something others have noticed. They have noticed. He ends the wandering with these commentary words. You cannot at the same time be on the mountain and in the valley. But your way leads you from mountain to valley, from valley to mountain. Much begins amusingly and leads in to the dark. Hell has many levels. Then starts the next fantasy, and I won't go into this one in much detail. I'll let you read it. Next night, he finds himself in a gray, snow-covered land. There he meets a lowly man, a destitute man. He calls him a rogue. And he hears the story, the meager story of his life, of his loves. And then Jung watches the man die, gurgling and drowning in the blood as he coughs from tuberculosis during the night. Hell has many levels. He gives in commentary. A destitute joins me and wants admittance into my soul. And I am thus not destitute enough. He leads to the depths, to the ground where I can see the heights. Without the depths, I do not have the heights. I may be on the heights, but precisely because of that, I do not become aware of the heights. I therefore need the bottommost for my renewal. If I am always on the heights, I wear them out, and the best becomes atrocious to me. I went into the inner death and saw that the outer dying is better than inner death. I went into the inner death and saw that outward dying is better than the inner death. Inner death? What is inner death?
Loss of soul.
Loss of soul. Or maybe not even finding soul. Never finding soul. Isn't that a terrible death that we face? My God, I see it. I've known it. So have you. And I decided to die outside and to live within. For that reason, I turned away from death and sought the place of the inner life. I'm just going to go a few more minutes. I want to tell you one last fantasy. One last imagination. One last adventure in this segment. We've got more to come. More to come, folks. But it's the story of Ammonius. Ammonius the Anchorite. This happened on December 30th of 1913. And in preface, on that day, in Jung's Black Book Journal, he wrote these words. These words are not part of the text of Liber Novus. These are in his journal, and Dr. Sean Bassani gives them to us in a footnote. This is what he wrote. And once again, remember, December 30th, this stuff has been going on since Christmas Day in profound intensity now. The Mysterium, the Red One, the Castle in the Forest, the Lowly One. This just wham, I mean, up and down. Jung says, writes in his journal, "All kinds of things lead me far away from my scientific endeavor, which I thought I had subscribed to firmly. I wanted to serve humanity through it, and now, my soul, you lead me to these new things." The heroic image? I wanted to serve humanity through it, through my science. I mean, that's young Dr. Jung, and right? This dude just got punched in the nose, okay? "I wanted to serve humanity through it, and now, my soul, you lead me to these new things. Yes, it is the in-between world, the pathless, the manifold dazzling. I forgot that I had reached a new world, which had been alien to me previously. I see neither way nor path. I feel that a large chunk of my science has broken off. I suppose it must be like this for the sake of the soul and her life. I find the thought that this must occur only for me agonizing, and that perhaps no one will gain insight from my work. I thought that this must happen to me only me agonizing." Look, the guy understands that what he's doing here is not a common experience, right? How the hell is he going to share this? I mean, I'm having a bit of difficulty. He had a bit of difficulty most of his life. He could never even talk about this stuff. He never revealed it to the world. He couldn't. Because what? Well, you're facing that problem right now, folks. "I find the thought that this must occur only for me agonizing, and that perhaps no one will gain insight from my work. But my soul demands this achievement. I should be able to do this just for myself, without hope, for the sake of God. This is truly a hard way. But what else did those anchorites of the first centuries of Christianity do? They left wife and child, wealth, glory, and science, and turned towards the desert. For God's sake, so let it be." And that night, the fantasy. He's in the desert. "I find footsteps in the sand." And he follows the footsteps. And he's led to the humble dwelling of an anchorite, a solitary monk, living in the Syrian desert. He actually wrote a letter that night in which he said he had been in the 3rd century. The old man lives alone in the desert, reading, studying one book, the Gospel of John. There in the solitude, with the sun, and one book for years and years and years. In these conversations, which I will not quote or repeat in their entirety because I simply cannot summarize them, there is a rich and beautiful contemplation of the Gospel of John. If you've ever read this book and spent some time with its message, you'll find this a very beautiful passage. I found it meaningful. And when I read this, I was really blown away. I was quite moved. And as they talk, it's clear that Jung is moved. But something else slowly enters into the conversation that I did not catch. I'll tell you, I did not catch this the first time I read it. I did not know what was going on here. After they've been talking for quite a while about Ammonius's solitary contemplation of the Word of God, the Word made flesh, the darkness in the light. The light in the darkness. There's the sense that Jung has seen, he intuits something missing in Ammonius. He has seen clearly into the mystery of the word, the logos, and the light in darkness, Ammonius has. But he's so singular, so focused, so isolated, so removed out there in the desert from community. And Jung asks him at the end of their dialogue, which goes on for 2 days, 2 nights. Jung says, "Have you found out the meaning which is yet to come?" Ammonius, "No, not yet. It's very difficult. But I hope I'll succeed. Sometimes it seems to me that I need the stimulation of others, but I realize that those are the temptations of Satan." Jung, "Don't you believe that you would succeed if you were nearer men?" Ammonius, "Perhaps you're right." He looks at me suddenly, as if doubtful and suspicious. "But," he continues, "I love the desert. Do you understand? This yellow, sun-glowing desert. Here you can see the countenance of the sun every day. You are alone. You see glorious Helios." "No, no, that is pagan. What's wrong with me? I'm confused." "You're Satan. I recognize you. Give way, adversary." He jumps up, incensed, and wants to lunge at me. But I am far away in the 20th century. End of vision. Ammonius is a bit similar, again, to that old scholar in the castle. Intent on his spiritual inquiry, his scholarly work, seeking spirit and light. Maybe a bit like Jung in his thrust into psychological science during the prior decade, in his image of himself, the solitary. Very singular in focus. And what is missing? Life, community, desire, immediacy of relationship and its manifold complexities. Human community. Then Jung makes this commentary. "The solitary lives in endless desert full of awesome beauty. He looks at the whole and at inner meaning. He loathes manifest diversity if it is near him. He looks at it from afar in its totality. Consequently, silvery splendor and joy and beauty cloak diversity for him. What is near him must be simple and innocent, since close at hand the manifold and complicated tear and break through silvery splendor. No cloudiness of the sky, no haze or mist is allowed in the whole. Consequently, the solitary loves the desert above all, where everything nearby is simple and nothing turbid or blurred lies between him and the far away." And he continues, "The solitary went into the desert to find himself, but he did not find himself, but rather the manifold meaning of Holy Scripture." He did not find himself, but rather the manifold meaning of Holy Scripture. "He wanted to find what he needed in the outer, but you find manifold meaning only in yourself, not in things. The meanings that follow one another do not lie in things, but lie in you. You are subject to many changes insofar as you take part in life. Things also change. But you do not notice this if you do not change. But if you change, the countenance of the world alters. The manifold sense of things is your manifold sense. It is useless to fathom it in things. And this probably explains why the solitary went into the desert and fathomed the things, but not himself. And therefore, what happened to every desirous solitary also happened to him. The devil came to him with a smooth tongue and clear reasoning and knew the right word at the right moment. He lured him to his desire. I had to appear to him as the devil, since I had accepted my darkness. I ate the earth, and I drank the sun, and I became a greening tree that stands alone and grows. End quote. Jung was Ammonius's devil. I got to tell you, I've often wondered if Jung really thought he was in the 3rd century. If that he really thinks has happened. Sort of, you know, time shift. The way Jung was experiencing some of these things, I suspect he did wonder. And he did write a letter on December 31st that is in the Jung archives where he says, I was in the Syrian desert in the 3rd century. Bizarre. Yes, bizarre.
Not in that state, though.
But can you imagine this poor Syrian monk in the 3rd century, and all of a sudden he's talking to Carl Gustav Jung? My God! The poor man! Well, we meet Ammonius. We find out what Jung does to Ammonius a little bit later. We'll get there in the second part. And late in life, you know, this idea that Jung was the devil to Ammonius. Late in life, there's something he said to a lady patient. I can imagine myself in many instances where I would become sinister to you. Here he is, the analyst, speaking to the patient in this conversation. For instance, if life had led you to take up an artificial attitude, then you wouldn't be able to stand me because I am an actual being. By my very presence, I crystallize. I ferment. Okay. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back to 2 more visions from this period. Thank you.